From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! Guess who came to dinner? We examine the guest list from the state dinner President Clinton threw for Chinese President Jiang Zemin. We look at union organizing on the border and how the Mexican government is trying to stop it. And on this Halloween, a delusion of Satan, the full story of the Salem witch trials. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yes, it's all on videotape, and police videotape on that. The videotape was released yesterday. It shows protesters sitting around a tree stump in California Congressmember Frank Riggs' office in Eureka, California, and screaming as deputies pulled back their heads, opened their eyes, and applied the burning chemical to their eyeballs. The video, made by the sheriff's office during the October 16th incident, was played for reporters yesterday as lawyers announced a federal lawsuit. The U.S. District Court suit said officers violated standard police practices as well as guidelines from the National Law Enforcement Policy Center for use of pepper spray. Those guidelines specify it should not be discharged into eyes at distances less than 2 feet. The company says that the tear gas should not be applied at distances at less than 3 feet and should not be used on people in restraints and should not be used as punishment. The suit was filed on behalf of 9 demonstrators who were protesting Pacific Lumber's plans to log old-growth forests and a proposed federal settlement that the demonstrators consider inadequate. The demonstrators were charged with trespassing. The suit seeks damages for pain and suffering, punitive damages, and a court order forbidding the use of liquid pepper spray by Humboldt County sheriffs and Eureka police on peaceful, nonviolent protesters who pose no threat to the safety of any person. A second tape shows similar events in the lobby of Pacific Lumber Company headquarters in nearby Scotia on September 25th. In both cases, demonstrators linked hands inside metal sleeves and refused to let go until after the liquid was applied. The attorney for the demonstrators is Mark Harris.
That is one of the most extreme acts of barbarism in the annals of American law enforcement.
That was not agreed to by Congressmember Frank Riggs. He said, I think under the circumstances, this was probably an appropriate use of force as opposed to the laying on of hands or some other technique. Bo Phillips, a spokesperson for Riggs, said the protesters terrorized and assaulted 2 female employees of the congressmember, vandalized the office, and trespass on federal property. The protesters deny these charges. Eureka Police Chief Arnie Millsap said, that's not torture. This is an outrageous accusation brought about by people who have absolutely no respect for the rights of others at all. Again, the sound of protesters at Congressmember Frank Riggs' office as police applied tear gas to their eyeballs. The U.S. has warned Iraq that it faces serious consequences after Baghdad went through with its threat and barred 2 American weapons inspectors from entering the country. Washington has renewed its push to impose new Iraq sanctions, including a travel ban, and refuses to rule out military measures in the confrontation. A campaign spending overhaul will come up for a Senate vote early next year in an agreement by Republican and Democratic leaders that breaks a legislative logjam. Besides a March 6th opening of debate on the McCain-Feingold bill, the accord would clear the way for a vote by November 7th on fast-track trade legislation. Also, there will be a press conference held today, 1 Eastern Standard Time, by Fred Thompson, the head of the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee. It is unclear what he will announce, perhaps the end of the Senate campaign finance abuse hearings. Meanwhile, Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt told the Senate campaign panel that contributions to Democrats played no role in the rejection of an Indian casino, even though a lobbyist said he mentioned them. Babbitt contends it was an inartful ploy to get rid of the lobbyist. The incident led to a Justice Department inquiry. Postmaster General Runyon agreed to pay $27,000 to settle Justice Department conflict of interest charges. The case involved his participation in talks on a deal to put Coca-Cola vending machines in post offices. Runyon held $350,000 of Coke stock at the same time. Federal Teamsters investigators are examining the financial dealings of a Chicago local that supports James Hoffa for union president. Investigators speaking on condition of anonymity say they want to find out if pension fund assets were misused to enrich union officials. Some 30,000 Algerians marched through their capital in the largest anti-government protest since the military voided a Muslim fundamentalist election victory in 1992. Protesters, including opposition as well as government parties, pro-government parties, charged fraud in last week's government victory in local votes. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Guess who came to dinner on Wednesday night's gala dinner for President Jiang Zemin of China at the White House? There was, of course, the usual sprinkling of senators, congressmembers, and top government officials, but also represented at the state dinner were corporate CEOs, notably from the computer and nuclear industries, as well as big-time media moguls and news personalities. We're going to go to that in a second, but right now I'm joined by Juan Gonzalez, my co-host. He's a columnist with the New York Daily News and with a national magazine in these times. Juan, unbelievable story about these protesters in California fighting for the preservation of the old-growth forests and the police tactics that were used.
Good day, Amy. It's amazing that in the very week that Congress is lecturing Chinese leaders on abuses of human rights, something like this can happen in the office of a congressman of the United States.
And also that Frank Riggs, the Republican congressmember from California, from that district, says that what happened was appropriate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, well, it's typical of what's occurring throughout the country as more and more police departments and law enforcement groups are being allowed to do virtually anything that they want to U.S. citizens.
Well, also interesting that this was police videotape that was released, and the police see it as vindication of what they were doing, say they warned the protesters that they would do this if they didn't leave. I was thinking, I mean, they could have also warned them, we'll shoot them, we'll cut off their hands if they don't leave. So the warning was there.
Yes, it's amazing development.
Well, we'll certainly do more on this on Monday. But right now we're going to take a look at that state dinner that happened on Wednesday night in Washington, D.C. Yes, the telecommunications industry was there and the nuclear industry was there. Also, the reporters were there, and I'm not talking about so much covering the event as being on the invitation list. Some of those that were there.
This is the CBS Evening News, with Dan Rather reporting from CBS News headquarters in New York.
Good evening.
In fact, U.S. officials say Zhang took such a hard line on human rights this week that the president felt he had to speak out even more strongly during their joint appearance.
Zhang gave almost nothing and got what he wanted. Andrea Mitchell, NBC News, Washington.
The issue of Tibet is clearly a sensitive one with the Chinese leader. One reason is the vocal opposition to China's policy in Tibet. It has grown in this country from Hollywood to the halls of Congress.
And a footnote, or hat note, actually, Mrs. Jiang Zemin. It turns out this souvenir bonnet the Chinese president's wife was given during their tour of Colonial Williamsburg was not made in the USA. It was made in China.
That's right. That is Dan Rather. That is Andrea Mitchell of NBC and Tom Brokaw of NBC, Dan Rather, of course, of CBS. And all of them were at the state dinner, at least according to the guest list that was released by the Associated Press and published in the New York Times yesterday under the headline Dining with Presidents Albright to Zuckerman. Interesting guest list.
Yes, well, you know, Diane Sawyer was there, too. But where was Peter Jennings? Did he do something? Did he put out a report that was especially critical to the White House lately?
Well, we're joined by someone who has been looking at the pundits and particularly the newscasters that have been participating in some of the news events that they cover. Jeff Cohen joins us. He is the founder and executive director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Did this surprise you?
It was a little more blatant than I've seen in the past. It's quite an amazing thing when you look at the whole guest list and you see that more than 20 of the people on the list are either executives or leading figures in the media industry. No other industry was represented like that at the state dinner. And, you know, if you believe in democracy, you believe that there should be a fourth estate watchdogging political and economic power. But what you have here is more like a fourth branch of government. You have people that should be on the outside looking, analyzing the appropriateness of a state dinner. Instead, they're on the inside feasting at the state dinner on the chilled lobster with corn leek relish. And it's totally inappropriate. You know, when you hear these people, whether it's Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw or Diane Sawyer, pontificating about objectivity, and there are people on the outside protesting the state dinner while they're feasting, it shows they're not even pretending. They're not even bothering with the pretense of objectivity now.
You know, Andrea Mitchell, that was an interesting one because, yes, you heard her actually reporting on the state dinner, but she was there on the guest list as the wife of Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. So she was playing two roles there.
Yeah, and it's the same thing. How objective can you be? I can't imagine these people going to a major dinner honoring Minister Farrakhan. I can't imagine these people going to a major dinner honoring the leader of the new Teamsters, Ron Carey. But here they are at a dinner for one of the most controversial figures in the world, and it's considered appropriate now. And, you know, I'm thinking of who's the one who, if they could get some time with Jiang Zemin, who's the one who's going to say, Mr. President, how can you defend your policy in Tibet? What are you doing about human rights and labor rights in China? You know, you might think of Sam Donaldson as that individual. Or talking to a U.S. official. How could you be feasting this individual? Well, how can Sam Donaldson ask such a question when his co-anchor, Diane Sawyer, was feasting that individual? I mean, all lines that were supposed to separate the press and state have been broken down. You know, there were protesters outside the state dinner. If we knew what kind of media list would have been there, fair activists would have been there with our chant, 2, 4, 6, 8, separate the press and state.
Well, not only the on-air personalities, but many of the owners, clearly Michael Eisner of Disney, who also happens to be the boss over at ABC, Catherine Graham of The Washington Post, Pinch Sulzberger of The New York Times. Basically, you had the and let's not leave out my own boss, Mort Zuckerman, the publisher of U.S. News and World and the New York Daily News. You basically had the media establishment of the country at this dinner. It's amazing that the Times clearly raises no criticism. They at least did publish the guest list. That was a public service.
That was the beginning. But you're right. The media. I mean, the last sacred cow. The ultimate sacred cow is the media itself. To have critical reporting on your own boss is just unacceptable. I mean, two bosses that you didn't mention are the head of Westinghouse, Michael Jordan, and the head of General Electric, Jack Welch. Now, the guy beaming at this dinner had to be Westinghouse's boss, Michael Jordan, because he's now, China has opened up to nuclear reactors. This deal, one of the main achievements, so-called, of this summit.
Considered the centerpiece.
Right,
the
is the nuclear deal that could open up a $60 billion market, and there's no company that's in the lead as Westinghouse. They might be building dozens of nuclear plants. So if you're a reporter, a serious reporter, I'm not talking about Dan Rather, Brokaw, the people that are feasting on the chilled lobster at the state dinner here. But if you're a serious reporter, your goal would be to get into this dinner, go up to Michael Jordan and ask Westinghouse and ask him some tough questions. Instead, they're, you know, pass the gravy, pass the relish.
Well, I guess, Jeff, the real question is, who was Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw and Andrea Mitchell, Diane Sawyer? Who were they representing? I mean, you have Dan Rather from CBS, owned by Westinghouse, which has just made this, gotten an incredible coup here because of the nuclear power agreement that was reached with China. You have Tom Brokaw of NBC, which is owned by General Electric. Is he representing his newsroom or is he representing the nuclear power industry?
Well, he certainly wasn't acting as a journalist in his capacity at the dinner. And people have to understand, it's not an abstraction when you talk about human rights, whether you're talking about it in your Eureka, California, or you're talking about it in China. I mean, in our country, we have built an environmental movement, and especially an anti-nuclear power movement, based on demonstrations, organizing, alternative press. Now, in China, And the nuclear industry is really in trouble. Their key is to get into countries that don't allow an environmental movement. Now, that's such an obvious story for a reporter to have covered. How important is it to the global movement of nuclear power, the global nuclear power industry, to have opened up China? But how are you going to ask those questions if you're sitting next to the Chinese leadership, or you're sitting next to Michael Jordan, the head of Westinghouse?
Well, we have this news that just came out in the New York Post today, and it says that Dan Rather is just cementing an agreement with CBS that he probably will stay on at least through the year 2002 with a contract of perhaps $21 million, bringing him up to par with Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings, who each makes $7 million a year, and that would be a three-year contract. So here he is negotiating with Westinghouse also at the same time.
And I'm sure we can count on him for that tough report about how environmentalists are treated in China if they protest this huge step forward toward nuclear power.
Or the problem with the nuclear power industry in this country.
Right. There's so many, when you look at what these companies want, there's a reason why the media industry was perhaps the single best represented industry at the state dinner for the Chinese leader. They have so much to gain. You know that Disney is moving in heavily into China. They already control about half of the sports programming on Chinese television. They're moving in their children's programming, their traditional Disney programming. And when Disney took over ABC, Michael Eisner was quoted about it. And this is what he said. There are many places in the world like China, India, other places that do not want to accept programming that has political content, but they have no problem with sports and they have no problem with the Disney kind of programming. Now, when the head of Disney is making comments like that, he's basically sending a message to his news, the news division that he owns at ABC. You're part of this company, too, and we don't want controversial political content out of you. You can go around the room in that state dinner and find companies where they have made apologies to China over content. Look at NBC, which also could benefit from the nuclear opening to China. NBC is owned by General Electric. During the 96 election, Bob Costas made some criticism during the Olympics of China's human rights policy and other things relating to China. It was the same week that GE negotiated another big deal with the government of China, and NBC formally apologized to the Chinese authorities for what Bob Costas has said. You could do the same thing with Rupert Murdoch. Murdoch's Star TV beams programming into China. And when the Chinese authorities complained that they also carry BBC on Murdoch's Star TV, which had some critical reporting on human rights in China, what did Murdoch do? He simply removed BBC from Star Television.
There were quite a few also telecommunications and computer executives, Ray Smith of Atlantic Bell, Steve Jobs of Apple Computer, and
Michael Armstrong, I think, right?
Right. So what do you make of the special emphasis there?
They're all getting in. I mean, they're all getting in to open up China for their companies and their industries, but particularly their companies. It's so far along that it's important who you sat with at that state dinner, which is why the role of journalism is so crucial. A journalist who got into that dinner, it should have been a coup. And it would have been a coup because you would have figured out which company executive was sitting next to which vice president of China or a vice premier of China and what they might have been discussing. That's what the American public had a right to know. They didn't have a right to have our journalists, so-called, sitting there enjoying the feast next to the people, both in the U.S. ruling establishment and the Chinese ruling establishment that they should have been reported on. And again, what I think the American people support closening relations between the American people and the Chinese people. What this is about is the closening in relationships between the U.S. government elite and the U.S. corporate elite and the Chinese government elite. And that's all this is about.
Jeff Cohen, you mentioned sacred cows, but I have to say there were no sacred cows there, considering it was pepper-crusted Oregon beef that was served at the state dinner.
You know, I mean, the interesting thing is all of the leading pundits on China were also there. Henry Kissinger, now a lobbyist for Disney in opening up China for Disney, he was there.
Right. Well, he was hired by Disney to smooth the waters because they have a film coming out on Tibet.
Right, one film on Tibet, but they've been turning somersaults to please the establishment of China ever since. But you had Alexander Haig there. You had Scowcroft there. These are the experts, and again, they're all feasting. These are the experts that these TV networks typically turn to for quote, independent punditry on China, I guess they could have just turned to Al Haig or Henry Kissinger in the tux, and it would have been very easy. The whole thing is truly revelatory of the fact that we don't have anything close to a fourth estate. It's just the media more a fourth branch of government.
Jeff, if you can stay with us for a minute, I just wanted to find out about the battle you've waged for years to get the networks to identify people like Kissinger, Haig, and others to identify them as having business interests in the countries that they're talking about. But we're going to talk about that in a minute. Jeff Cohen, our guest from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Stay with us here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, heard from Hawaii to Maine, from Washington to Florida, California, Minneapolis, and lots of states in between California and New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Let's just finish up our conversation with Jeff Cohen, co-founder and executive director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And then we're going to turn to a labor issue on the border with Mexico. And finally, because this is Halloween, we're going to be looking at the Salem witch trials. But Jeff, about that battle that you've had to honestly, accurately, and fairly represent the pundits that the networks have on TV on issues like China.
In the late 80s, we sent letters to every TV network in the country, and they all used Henry Kissinger as their main expert on China. And we sent them letters pointing out that Henry Kissinger was at that time the head of China Ventures, whose literature talked about how they had one goal, which was getting U.S. investors into joint ventures with the State Bank of China, period. And also through Kissinger and Associates, they opened up China for other huge U.S.-based multinational corporations. And we said, is it sufficient to identify someone like Kissinger as a former Secretary of State when they were former Secretary of State 10, 15, 20 years ago? What have they done since? And don't your viewers have a right to know? Same thing with Al Haig. He's always just the former Secretary of State. Brent Scowcroft, his former government official status. These people are high-paid, high-powered lobbyists for the most powerful economic interests in our country. Indeed, Kissinger may be as powerful today as he was when he was the Secretary of State in the 1970s. But it took us, when we finally got anyone to ask Kissinger the $64,000 question, Mr. Former Secretary, it was Michael Kinsley, you know, you are also today involved in this. So aren't you a little partial in what you're saying about how we should overlook China's human rights violations? And Kissinger's reaction, he was so shocked at hearing the question, he called Michael Kinsley a smart aleck on CNN's Crossfire. I never heard the question asked anywhere else besides Kinsley and McNeil Lehrman. Both the questions were bad. They were squeamish. They were on their, you know,
and not almost, followed up.
Right. Not followed up. And in fact, Kinsley looked embarrassed that we had forced him to ask the question. So and it's something that media consumers should really be getting on. When they hear someone introduced as a former Secretary of State and they were former as of 5, 10, 15 years ago, demand to find out who that individual is currently lobbying for. That's what's relevant when these people are brought into a discussion on American television.
Well, Jeff Cohen, I want to thank you very much for joining us again. Jeff Cohen of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, you put out Extra, the newsletter. If people want to get a hold of it, where can they call?
We've got an 800 number, 1-800-847-3993.
One more time?
1-800-847-3993.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
Well, you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move south of the border, there's been also a lot of talk of the economy this week, at the same time that we hear that there will be a vote on fast-track legislation in Congress that President Clinton has been pushing hard for the authority to bring trade legislation to Congress where Congress cannot amend it, just vote up or down on it. And of course, there was the Wall Street plunge and then rally this week, something you've been covering, Juan.
Yes, and I think that, there was some indication by some of these experts, these so-called financial experts, that the tremendous drop on Monday and the resurgence Tuesday meant that the stock market had recovered. In reality, there are tremendous problems. This could very well have been a major crash that occurred. And one of the things that's fascinating is that no one in the media is really covering the tremendous involvement of currency speculators in all of the problems that have been occurring. In fact, right now, Mexico and Brazil, their stock markets have been plummeting, and people are very worried about that. But it's largely, it seems to me, from what I've been able to follow, because currency speculators who lost huge sums of money in Asia are dumping Mexican and Brazilian stocks, which is going to mean it's going to have a tremendous impact on the United States, since so much of the United States' growing trade has been with Mexico and in Asia as well. So that I think that I was talking to several labor leaders who, unfortunately, so many unions have bought into this idea that the stock market provides the best return for their pension funds, and they've increased their equities exposures to about 50% in a lot of these funds. And I talked to one guy who said, yeah, we lost about $8 to $10 million in our small pension fund earlier this week. So that a lot of labor leaders, unfortunately, are in this situation where they allowed their pension funds to be to head more in equities direction. So that they have a big problem.
Well, I haven't seen many labor leaders quoted this week when it comes to the stock market. But speaking of Mexico, in a precedent-setting election in Mexico earlier this month, workers from a maquiladora factory in Tijuana voted to be represented by an independent labor federation, the Authentic Labor Front, known as FAT. The vote marked the first time an independent union has won the right to represent workers at a maquiladora factory on the U.S.-Mexican border. But the company, Han Young, and the Mexican government have dragged their feet in recognizing the vote. And since the election just over 3 weeks ago, four workers who supported the independent union have been fired. We're joined right now by David Bacon. He's a journalist with Pacific News Service and a producer at KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. We're also joined by Mary Tong, who's the executive director of the Support Committee for Maquiladora Workers based in San Diego. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! We want to begin with David. David, lay out the scene. You've been covering this election. Why should an election of, what, some 80 workers matter to people all over this country?
Well, I think you said it yourself, Amy, when you mentioned that the Clinton administration has finally convinced Gingrich to allow a vote on fast track in Congress. Because the last time we were here 5 years ago, when NAFTA was in the Congress, the administration made a lot of promises about what the labor side agreement of NAFTA would do to protect the rights of workers in Mexico. And the fact is that that labor side agreement has been really worthless in protecting those rights. What's happened at Han Young, that election, kind of is an illustration of the continuing difficulties that workers have in trying to organize unions of their own choice to exercise power in those unions. And what's even most important, to use those unions to raise the wages in the maquiladoras. What happened at Han Young was that, I'll kind of describe what I saw when I was at the election, and that was that the Han Young workers themselves, after a long odyssey of even getting to this election, went down to the office of the Mexican Labor Board in Tijuana on the morning of October 6th to vote. And they lined up in front of the Labor Board offices. When the conference room and the voting process was opened, they went in one by one and voted in the way in which workers vote in a Mexican union election, which is an open process, not secret ballot. And after they had finished voting, and the voting was almost all over, in fact, they were kind of closing down the process, all of a sudden, another group of people showed up. And the workers who had voted previously started chanting fraud, 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 because the people who showed up to vote, this second group of people, included supervisors. I interviewed one man who admitted to me that he was a company supervisor. They can't legally vote in Mexico any more than they can in the U.S. There were people there who had worked at the plant, if they had indeed worked at the plant at all, had worked there for such a short time that the other workers waiting in line had to remind them of the name of the company that they were working for when they were asked by the Mexican Labor Board officials who were running the election. So the Labor Board in Tijuana permitted all of these workers to vote. And fortunately, the number of workers from the factory, the legitimate workers, were still a large enough number so that in the end, they still constituted a majority. But since the counting of the votes in that election, the Mexican Labor Board has still not certified the results of that election, and it's still sort of hanging in the balance there.
Well, I'd like to bring in Mary Tong here from the Support Committee for Maquiladora Workers in San Diego. How prevalent are these corrupt practices in unionization efforts in Tijuana?
Well, Juan, unfortunately, it's a pattern of practice, and that's precisely what the complaint that we filed yesterday with the National Administrative Office in Washington says. The National Administrative Office is the body that is set up under the labor side accords of NAFTA that's supposed to take complaints in regard to where any of the government's parties within NAFTA are not enforcing or actually violating their own labor laws. And that has been the pattern of practice of the Labor Board. But you have to understand the labor boards in Tijuana consist of a president who's appointed by the governor's office, and the governor has stated very clearly that as far as he's concerned, what's good for the maquiladora owners is what's good for the state of Baja California, and he is going to do whatever necessary to promote their interests. So, and in fact, the Friday before the Monday of the election, the governor had demanded the resignation of the president of the labor board because he was not supposed to have allowed for this election to go through in the first place. So the election was actually overseen by somebody who was temporarily in charge because the president had been forced to resign.
And how many workers in the maquilas are actually unionized, or if they are unionized, have a union that is actively defending them?
Well, it has to be understood that the vast majority, over 90%, are supposedly represented under contracts with official unions, but workers, for the most part, do not know this. For the most part, workers never see these unions. These unions don't meet with workers. They never show the workers the contract. And this is something that the employer pays the union for. The unions, depending on how many workers are in a plant, will come and pick up a paycheck every week or every 2 weeks directly from the company. And the purpose is what we call protection contracts. The companies are paying for protection to keep legitimate organizing out. And these supposed official unions actually form more of a threat to workers organizing even than the management, because they're being paid to keep the organizing out. So these are the goons who will come and intimidate people, threaten people, or try to pay people off to keep them from organizing.
We're talking to David Bacon, journalist with Pacific News Service and KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, and Mary Tong, executive director of the Support Committee for Maquiladora Workers based in San Diego. Mary, it's nice to hear from you. The last time we saw each other was at the Republican National Convention when you took me and some others across the border to some of these factories and to some of the actually toxic dumps where factories who have left leave their toxic waste, whether it's, you know, batteries or chemicals. In fact, I was very struck at the time by the fact that you at the Committee for Maquiladora Workers would trade off with others in leading the tour that you do across the border, because each one of you, when you did it long enough, would get headaches and get sick from being in these areas.
It's true. I believe, Amy, we went to an area where, in fact, the level of lead in the soil was over 40 8,000 parts per million, when over 200 parts per million would be considered a toxic waste dump in the U.S. And that was on a mesa over a community where now there is a level of birth defects and cancer and other diseases that is just astronomical.
What about the women in these factories? And wasn't it true that you recently won a case around women who are being forced to be tested to see if they were pregnant every month?
Actually, we were involved in helping Human Rights Watch to document the fact that it's the common practice of maquiladoras to do pregnancy testing. And normally they'll do pregnancy testing before they hire women, again after the 3-month probationary period before they hire them as permanent workers. And then many do it on a periodic basis after that. But that case is just coming up now. It's just been accepted by the National Administrative Office to be heard. There's expected to be hearings in the near future. We were involved in filing what was the first lawsuit on behalf of Mexican workers in U.S. courts against a transnational corporation involving questions of labor rights, and that involved 118 workers who were charging sexual harassment against their employer, National O-Ring, which is based out of Downey, California.
And the workers were being forced to dance for him?
The president and CEO of the company in Downey went to Tijuana to the maquiladora, where most of the employees were women from 16 to 24 years of age, and insisted that they do a bikini contest for him to videotape. And when they refused, he went around and literally twisted people's arms and insisted that people do this, sent his assistant around to threaten them that they might lose their jobs if they did not comply. And so 11 of the women agreed. He didn't realize, though, that one of the women managed to secretly take a photo of him videotaping the women. So afterwards, when we were involved in the questioning as part of the case, and he denied all of this and said the woman had completely made this up, the attorney was able to present in front of him a huge blow-up of himself videotaping these women in bikinis. And he just went completely white and told his attorney he had to postpone the question. But it ended up being a tremendous victory for the workers, and set a precedent for workers from outside the U.S. to be able to sue U.S.-based transnational corporations in U.S.
But you had to take that protest here to the United States and the Mexican government folks in Mexico could not raise this kind of protest or outrage over this kind of treatment of their own nationals by these foreign corporation owners?
Well, there's two things going on. The workers had tried to file actions in Mexico. There were subpoenas issued by the courts there, in both the criminal courts and the labor board, and the U.S. company did not respond. There's no way that the Mexican courts can reach out and catch someone across the border. There were actually warrants for this man's arrest if he were to enter Mexico, but he didn't go back to Mexico after the criminal case was filed. But the fact is that the Mexican government has, for some time now, since the beginning of the Maquiladora program, really been using the fact of the low wages, the failure to enforce Mexican labor law and environmental laws and health and safety laws as enticement for these companies to come to Mexico. They're very reluctant to pursue anything against U.S. companies who are violating the laws.
David Bacon, covering this particular election that took place in the Maquiladora factory in Tijuana, the election of the Authentic Labor Front, the FAT, to represent the workers there. How are you organizing in this country? Aren't there protests that are happening now?
Well, in fact, on last Saturday, there were picket lines and leafleters out in front of Hyundai dealerships in over 15 cities in the U.S., and there are going to be further demonstrations in front of even more Hyundai dealerships this coming Saturday. And this is an effort to hold Hyundai Corporation, which is Hanyoung, the place where the workers voted, is a contract plant. It's a contractor to the big Hyundai Maquiladora complex in Tijuana. And so the purpose of these protests is to hold the parent corporation responsible for what the violation of the rights of the workers that are taking place in the contract plant there. There are also efforts being made by the AFL-CIO, for instance, to talk to the union for workers at Hyundai in Korea, the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, which has written a letter to the management of the plant, Hanyoung, telling the management of the plant that the union in Korea is aware of the situation and that it expects the management of this plant to live up to its obligations under Mexican law. I do want to add something as well to what Mary has been saying about the lack of enforcement of workers' rights in Mexico as a policy of the Mexican government to encourage foreign investment. And this is a policy not just of the Mexican government, but indirectly of our government as well. That's what NAFTA was really all about, was cooperation between the U.S., the Mexican, and the Canadian governments in maintaining a low-wage policy, which would provide a way of supplying inexpensive labor to U.S., primarily U.S. corporations and other foreign corporations operating in Mexico. But that's also the significance of this election, and that is that if workers are able to organize independent unions in the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Maquiladora factories along the border, which employ now close to a million workers, what that's going to do is it's going to allow those workers to begin to change the terms under which they work, to raise the wages, to improve the working conditions, and to fight against the policies which essentially are treating them as a cheap, exploitable labor force. It's going to give them a much bigger voice. And that's also why the Mexican government is not favorably disposed towards this effort, and also why the U.S. government has been, in essence, inactive and silent on the protection of those workers' rights, even though this was something that it promised during the negotiation of the original NAFTA treaty. The U.S. government doesn't really want to see that happen anymore than the Mexican government does.
Well, David Bacon and Mary Tong, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Again, David Bacon, labor journalist with Pacific News Service and Pacifica radio station KPFA. Mary Tong, executive director of the Support Committee for Maquiladora Workers based in San Diego. And again, the latest news we have so far is that President Clinton is hoping for a vote on fast-track trade authority that could expedite Senate action on this front before a scheduled House vote November 7th. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Up next, we take a look at the history of witches on this Halloween. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, what are you going to be for Halloween?
I'm going to be myself.
I thought you might be playing perhaps, I don't know, Mort Zuckerman, the owner of New York Daily News, and dress up in a tuxedo and head off to the White House for a state dinner.
No, I'm terrified of Mort.
Well, today we're going to take a look at witches on this Halloween. The persistence of witch hunts has continued from Puritan Massachusetts through the McCarthy era to today. The stark facts of the Salem witch trials from 1692 to 1693 include the arrest and imprisonment of hundreds of people, the deaths of two dozen, the destitution of a community, and the beginning of the end for Puritan theocracy in New England. But the reasons behind the nightmare remain an elusive mystery. But here to elucidate them is Frances Hill. She's the author of a brand new book called A Delusion of Satan, The Full Story of the Salem Witch Trials. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Frances.
Good morning.
Well, why don't you start off by just setting the scene for us back in 1692 and earlier, and what led to these trials?
Puritan Massachusetts was a very tense, rigid, anxious, fearful society in which people were in the grip of a terrifying ideology, according to which if you weren't a member of the elect, you went to hell. They went to church every Sunday to be preached at for probably sort of most Sundays 5 hours altogether about the terrors of hell. The rest of the time they were leading lives of great hardship with the constant threat of Indian attacks, smallpox epidemics, political turmoil. It was a very, very anxious place to live. And it was within that context that the witch hunt started, that you had a little group of girls going into hysterics as a result of freaking themselves out by getting involved in fortune-telling. And once the hysterical fits had started, continuing and being promoted by the adults around, who came to believe that the girls were bewitched and started asking them to name witches. And quite soon you had people feeding them names in an attempt to start picking off their enemies by this means. And so the whole thing escalated until the point when, as you say, there were hundreds in jail and 20 people had been executed.
One of the things that struck me is that as you're talking about this is this fundamentalist strain in the American religious bent that emanates or originates in the Puritan experience versus, let's say, the more moderate Anglican experience of some of the southern colonies or the mixed religious experience of the middle states of the United States. I was struck in seeing, especially when I saw the film remake of The Crucible recently, the separation of men and women on different sides of the church. It reminds me very much of the sort of fundamentalist bent of, let's say, some of the fundamentalist Muslim sects or the Hasidic sects among Jews. What is this? How strong has this fundamentalist strain been in American religious thought?
It does seem to have been very strong indeed, and something very dangerous, because any fundamentalist religion induces people to feel that they are righteous and good, and others who don't share their beliefs are thoroughly evil. And that can easily lead to a situation where they believe that it's right and proper to try and destroy those people. That's what happened in Salem, and that's what you see happening, you know, recurrently. Sometimes not strictly within a religious context, as in the case of McCarthyism, but in a climate of opinion, which I think has arisen because of the tendency that's there, because of that heritage, a fundamentalist way of looking at things.
Before we look at who's persecuted today, what about those women back in 1692? Who were they? Who were the women who were put on trial?
The ones who were accused? Well, they started out by being fairly obvious witch suspects. If you thought anybody was a witch, you would think of these particular people. There was a Caribbean slave, a beggar, an outcast, a woman with a very murky, dubious past. But as it went on, the women who were accused became absolutely respectable members of the community. In fact, one of them was particularly well known for her piety and respectability. She was looked up to. And the reason those women were being targeted was because they were enemies of the people who were doing the accusing. I mean, it became very political, in fact.
Were these women
independent women?
Not particularly, actually. I mean, one or two were, to some extent, yes. But quite honestly, that doesn't seem to have been a major factor. The reasons that the women were targeted were more to do with the local politics, the recent local history, and which faction was trying to do down which other faction, than to do with the status of the particular women who were being accused.
And what was the trial like?
Well, first the examinations and then the trials were bedlam. You had the magistrate asking questions of the accused, which implied he already was totally convinced of their guilt. You had the girls, the accusing girls, having hysterics in the courtroom, going into the most extraordinary fits in the courtroom. And we have eyewitness accounts of these, and they're described as having their tongues coming out of their mouths to an extraordinary length, their heads twisted round, their arms and legs twisted, blood gushing out of their mouths. And you had people in the congregation shouting out abuse of the accused and shouting out new accusations. It was like something out of Alice in Wonderland. It was just crazy, you know.
And in your book, you mention how the couple who were actually Caribbean Indian slaves, Native Americans, Tituba and John Indian, how they were initially focused on, because there was a tremendous strain within Puritanism that saw the Native American as satanic. I know a lot of the writings of Cotton Mather and some of the others, even John Winthrop, who was a more moderate wing of Puritanism, also saw many of the Indians as satanic.
Yes, I mean, Cotton Mather actually saw New England as the devil's last outpost. He claimed that the Indians were people who'd come from a race that had retreated to New England as the one place where missionaries couldn't reach them. And so the devil actually governed in New England, and the Puritans had arrived, as it were, to fight the devil, and there was this war going on, as he saw it, between God and Satan, between good and evil, and the Indians were all allied with the devil.
We're talking to Frances Hill. She's the author of A Delusion of Satan, the full story of the Salem witch trials. When I was in college, I lived in Mather House, named for him. I'm going to reassess the history here. Well, let's take this forward. Here you are, Frances, in the United States, but you're from Britain, so you have an interesting perspective on this country. Would you say what goes on in this country in terms of this sort of Puritan strain that has gone on right through to today, whether it takes on the religious zeal of the witch hunts or the political, almost like a religion, zeal of someone like McCarthy? Is it different than what you have in England?
Yes, it is, actually. There is a different flavour to it. I mean, it struck me when I first came many years ago, and I do still have that impression, that there is this tendency to see things very starkly in terms of good and evil, in terms of I'm right, you're wrong. Something that interested me very much was hearing a news report about what's happening in Jamestown, New York, about the young man who was given the HIV virus to a lot of young women. There was a woman on air saying, most of our kids are good kids, 95% of our kids are good kids, and the rest, the others, they just need some guidance. And I thought, here's an example of this. There's good kids and there's bad kids, you know, as opposed to a perspective in which you know that all teenagers are kind of a bit of one or the other, and anyway, some of what they're doing adults might not approve of, but is it necessarily that bad in moderation? You know, it was a very sort of stark view, and that seems to me something very American from my perspective.
One other thing that struck me about the Salem witch trial experience is the origin and development of what I would call the plea bargain in American history. This idea that if you recant and point the finger at someone else, you will be forgiven. And I see this as a journalist all the time, and especially in federal drug trials, or often the real culprits are the first ones to turn evidence against others, and by basically plea bargaining their way out, the justice system forgives them, and the ones who are tried most harshly may often not be the ones that are guilty, but the last ones who agreed to repent.
Mm. That's an interesting point. Yes, indeed. All the accused witches who confessed right from the start, they weren't forgiven, but they were sent to prison instead of being hanged.
Hanged, right, exactly.
Yeah. And it seems that one of the main reasons this was done was so that they could name other names.
Exactly.
You know. Mm. I mean, the chances are that if the witch hunt had gone on long enough, they might well have been hanged eventually.
What stopped the witch hunt?
Essentially, that the accusers started naming people who were high up in the society. And once you got people at the top of society being accused, suddenly they started thinking again about the validity of the kind of evidence that had been brought forward. You got this shift of opinion. The skeptical voices had already been there from the beginning, but very muted, you know, not heard. And when you got the girls starting to overreach themselves and eventually accusing the governor's wife of witchcraft, suddenly these voices began to be heard, began to be listened to, and you got the shift which led to what was called spectral evidence no longer being admissible in court. That
Frances Hill, I have a story to read that we got from something called Inside Academe, and it says, "Wanted, academic dean, witches need not apply. Searches for academic deans are often difficult, but rarely are they witch hunts. At the State University of New York at New Paltz, however, Roger Bowen, the president of the college, recently called off his college's search for a dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences after one of the three finalists proves to be a self-described witch. Rosemary Keefe Kerb, head of the English department at Southwest Missouri State University, was one of three under final consideration by the college search committee. But the committee got hold of her 1985 book, Lesbian Nuns Breaking Silence, and proceeded to suggest she might not be the right witch, we mean person, for the job. In that book, Dr. Kerb discussed her spirituality and conceded she led pagan ritual circles when she taught at Rollins College. She said, "I've never been initiated into a coven, but I like to call myself a witch because the word carries such a patriarchal taboo, and I feel a solidarity with the women who were burned as witches. I've participated in ritual circles celebrating solstices, equinoxes, and full moons, leading a ritual circle with women who have never practiced any pagan ceremony gives me a chance to preach my spirituality and practice consciousness raising." Well, that was in the book. Once the book surfaced, the president apparently decided consciousness raising was not in order and postponed a new search until the fall. Angry faculty members accused the administration of ignoring Kerb's excellent credentials. Kerb, meanwhile, would not confirm or deny whether she was a witch.
Well, no witch has ever done anything as frightening as has been done, you know, in the name of ideology of one sort or another, to scapegoat figures within a society.
And what about this obsession that Satan comes first and apparently most to women in much of the clearly it was the young teenagers and girls who came forward with their experiences first, and it was women who seemed to be have been targeted most, even though clearly there were men also who were executed. Do you see any significance in this?
Well, in the history of witchcraft generally, in the big European witch hunts, which happened much earlier than what happened in Salem, most of the accused were witches, but so were most of the accusers. It was something that was sort of going on more within the female population, as it were, than in the male population. And quite honestly, nobody really knows for sure why this should be so. They're all sorts of theories and speculation, but it's actually a very large and complicated subject. I mean, there's no one simple explanation for this. And in Salem, of course, quite a lot of men were accused as well, but there was certainly a tendency to go more for women because, historically, it had been women who were more likely to be witch suspects than men. So you'd get the wives of an enemy targeted rather than the man himself in several cases.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Frances Hill, for joining us. Frances Hill, author of A Delusion of Satan, The Full Story of the Salem Witch Trials. It's published by DeCapo Press. You can get in bookstores, or is there an 800 number that people can call?
Yes.
Looks like I've got it right here. 1-800-321-0050. That's 1-800-321-0050. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette copy by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our director is Leslie George. Errol Maitland is our New York engineer. Kevin Cartwright engineered from Berkeley, California. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Juan, happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, Amy.
I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And tune in on Monday when we will talk about the tear gas applied to the environmentalists in California. Also, tonight and tomorrow night, I look forward to seeing the listeners of WRPI in Troy, Albany, New York for their 40th anniversary. Thanks for listening.